I'm not sure exactly what Ben was trying to prove by showing like our whole library, but maybe it was that we really do read books, because I think I'm always talking to my sermons about movies, and that's where I'm going to start again today. So just I've read books before, but do you remember when the movie Titanic came out? I was in seventh grade, and it was like the movie for seventh graders to watch. It, like, all my friends went and saw it 7, 8, 9, 10 times. It was like a competition to see how many times you could go and see Titanic, right? And since I was in seventh grade, there were also seventh grade boys there. And they thought it was really funny to go up to people who hadn't seen the movie yet and say, I'm gonna ruin the ending for you. I'm gonna tell you how it ends. And the people who hadn't seen it yet would say, no, don't ruin it. And then they'd say, in the end, it sinks. Which is how we all know the Titanic ends, right? And they say, but that still doesn't ruin the movie, does it? Right? That's the joke. Because even if you know how something ends, there's still a whole adventure that happens in the story along the way. And I think that's how the Gospel of Mark is, really, for me. It's super exciting. So we'll be reading it all this year from, we started in Christmas, and we'll read it through Easter. We're doing the narrative lectionary. And just a refresher, or if you're here for the first time, the narrative lectionary is put together specifically, it's a set of readings for each Sunday, put together so that we get a sense of the story. So it doesn't jump around where we are in the Bible. It walks us through. So all fall, we read the whole Hebrew Bible, going in order through it. And now we'll read the Gospel of Mark, going through it, so that we can really get a sense of the story. And y'all, I know we think we know how it ends, but it is so exciting. So for me, Mark is really written like a suspense thriller. And actually, you know, you think you know how it ends, but Mark is never the one we read at Easter. So that Easter story, you know, that's not even how Mark really ends. I know. We'll read it this year for Easter, and like, you are in for a shock. You'll all be so disappointed. No, it's not that bad, but it's really interesting. But we'll be reading it through, and it'll be like a suspense thriller, even from the beginning. It's not the gospel story that we read at Christmas either. So you might remember from the pageant, remember Mark doesn't even tell a story about the birth of Jesus. Mark just jumps in with talking about what the prophets were saying, prepare the way of the Lord. And it begins with this line, the beginning of the good news about Jesus the Messiah, which might not seem like super exciting to you, but that's a really exciting line because the beginning of the good news about was actually, it's that Greek word, euangelion, for good news, which was used at the time, all the time, to mean news of victory. It was basically the Roman Empire's, like, political propaganda. So when they would begin, all the time the Roman government would come out with these, you know, statements to be read, and you would go out and say, the good news about so-and-so and such, and their victory over something else. And so that Mark chooses to begin his gospel with the good news. So you think you're hearing a statement about news of victory. And he says, the good news about Jesus Christ, the Messiah. That's already starting to push at some buttons. And if you're an original reader of that or hearer of this, you're thinking, oh, watch out. You know, maybe don't go that far deep end trying to poke at the Roman Empire. But he starts out that way. And also, remember, Mark is not a journal entry that is written as it's happening day by day. When Mark was written in the year 70, long after the fact. And it's written by an acquaintance of Paul named Mark. And the Roman Empire, when this is written, is still very much in power. And you'll remember the word Messiah had the whole connotation and was usually thought to mean somebody who would come and overthrow The messiahs that we think about from the Hebrew narrative are those political leaders who come in and overthrow and set the prisoners free and bring an overthrow of power. So to say the beginning of the good news of Jesus Christ the Messiah, to be reading that in a time where the Roman Empire was still very much in power, to claim that that is good news of victory of Jesus is kind of mind-blowing. And the gospel just takes off from there. It hits the ground running from this controversial opening and just keeps going. It goes straight to Jesus being baptized by John the Baptist in the River Jordan. We did that last week. And then right after that, the very next verses, and the Spirit immediately drove Jesus out into the wilderness. And he was in the wilderness for 40 days. And this immediately, that's a big word for Mark. We'll see it all through the Gospel of Mark as we read it. Everything is immediately, immediately, immediately. In fact, that Greek word for immediately is used 41 times in the Gospel of Mark, and only 10 times anywhere else in the New Testament. So for Mark, it's very much like, this is what's happening next. So it is like a suspense thriller where the action never stops. It keeps going. So Jesus goes straight into the wilderness. And while he's in the wilderness, John is arrested by Herod Antipas, the son of the Herod that we know maybe from the Christmas story. So not really on the side of the readers of this. So he's thrown in jail. And after John was arrested, Jesus hears about it, and he comes to Galilee, and he takes up John's place. He starts to build his own group of disciples. And he goes from town to town, calling to people. So one of the first things he does is he goes to the Sea of Galilee, and he walks by, and he sees Peter and Andrew, the brothers, in a boat fishing. And he calls to them and says, come with me. Leave your nets, come with me, and I will make you fish for people. And they do. Again, it says immediately. Immediately they drop their nets. And then James and John, same thing. They drop their nets. They come with Jesus. And they immediately get to work. They go to Capernaum, and Jesus teaches in the synagogue. And here's what he's doing. He's casting out spirits, and he's healing people. And he gets very famous very quickly. And people start coming to him to be healed. So really quickly in these first couple of chapters, Jesus is already crowded everywhere he goes. He can barely move, and people are just crowding around him. He'll try to take a break to pray or to rest. And the people, it says, they hunted him down and searched for him wherever he went. And they follow him from town to town. And at one really notable point, he's just at a house hanging out. They're trying to rest. And so many people come to gather around Jesus and his disciples that there's no longer room. It says even at the front door, there was no room for anyone. And so do you remember this story? That just imagine a house full of people. You can't even get in the front door. And four friends come with their friend who's paralyzed. And they're trying to get him to Jesus, and they can't. So they climb up on the roof, dig a hole through the roof, and lower their friend down into the middle of the house to be healed by Jesus. These are the kind of crowds we're talking about. And interesting enough, Jesus isn't telling people to spread the news. This is kind of important for how Mark's gospel unfolds. Jesus isn't telling people to, oh, go tell more people. Like, he doesn't have a very good PR campaign about advertising himself. In fact, just the opposite. There's this thing in the Gospel of Mark where the demons will look at Jesus and recognize him before he casts them out of a person. And he tells all of them, they all say, oh, we know who you are, you're Jesus. And he says, no, be quiet. Don't say anything. Don't tell anyone. And then a leper comes to him begging to be healed. And Jesus says, I'll heal you, but don't tell anyone. Keep it quiet. Just don't tell them. He, in fact, warns him sternly. And then heals him immediately, it says again. He says, see that you say nothing to anyone, but the leper doesn't listen. The leper goes out and and he began to proclaim it freely and to spread the word. And at that point, then, Jesus could no longer go anywhere. He stayed out in the country. He didn't even go into the towns. And people came to him, it says, from every quarter, from everywhere. People are just coming in. And the crowds are so big that he has to go out in a boat on the Sea of Galilee to get some distance. It says so the crowds won't crush him. He has to get on a boat out a distance to be able to talk to the people. And all the while, all of this is happening, Jesus is like the biggest celebrity in the land, and John the Baptist is still in prison. And John's disciples were obviously, they're really distraught, so they're fasting and praying in hopes that John will be rescued. And the Pharisees, so it's been a while since we've been reading the Gospels here, so just a reminder, the Pharisees are like the religious institution of the day, the establishment. They're the same religion as John and Jesus and his followers, but they're kind of the establishment guys. And they're not really on the same side as John, but even they are fasting for John and praying because they're wearing the like free John t-shirts, you know, like they're at least on the outside saying, yeah, let's get John out of prison. But Jesus and his disciples aren't fasting. So you can see, I mean, I don't know, like the suspense thriller things, you know. So they go to Jesus and they say, John's disciples are fasting, the Pharisees are fasting. Why are you and your disciples not fasting? And Jesus, instead of saying, oh, yeah, you're right, and putting on the free John t-shirt, he says instead this line about nobody puts new wine into old wineskins. Kind of saying like, yeah, you know, I don't know that John's going to get out of prison. This is kind of it. And so the Pharisees hear this and they're like, okay, we got to do something about this guy. But they're not quite sure yet. Still on the outside, they're like, free John. They're still the Pharisees are still following Jesus around. But it's starting to get really tense. So imagine being John's disciples. Or imagine being John the Baptist and hearing this and knowing this and thinking, wait a second. Did I just give my whole life for the wrong thing? Like, am I doing the wrong thing? Should we go back out to the River Jordan and be waiting for someone else? And imagine the Pharisees hearing all of this and thinking, there is the biggest celebrity of the day is not getting in line with us. So what are we going to do about it? And then imagine Jesus' disciples and how they're feeling. We just dropped our nets immediately. We left our jobs, committed our lives to following Jesus. And this isn't going the way that we thought. They're all kind of in this moment thinking, trying to figure out what it means, trying to figure out even who Jesus is. He doesn't seem to be wanting to spread this news about Messiah. And they're all kind of in this moment where the crowds, the rush, the people, the fame, the celebrity have kind of taken over the whole narrative. And so all of the kind of players in the middle are trying to find their spot. It's just like a suspense thriller. And then, okay, so then this is the really big part in Mark. They're trying to figure out what all of this means, and then Jesus on the Sabbath and his disciples are going through and picking the heads of grain and eating them, which was illegal to do on the Sabbath. And the Pharisees are still following him, and they say, what are you doing? You're not supposed to work on the Sabbath. And Jesus has this line, the Sabbath was made for humankind and not humankind for the Sabbath. So he's kind of saying, I'm not going to get in line with you or do what you say. And it's starting to get really serious for them. And then he restores a man with a withered hand on the Sabbath. So he goes from eating the grains of head into the synagogue. A man with a withered hand comes, and in front of everyone, he says, I'm going to heal this hand, even though it's illegal, and he does it. And so then it says, the Pharisees went out immediately and go to the Herodians, so the followers of Herod. They're still wearing their free John t-shirts, but they go to the followers of Herod, to like the enemies, and they plot how they're going to destroy Jesus. So now it's just the game is on. How are we going to catch him? How are we going to stop him while keeping up this whole front, while not angering these crowds that are crushing in and coming from everywhere? How are we going to get rid of him? And then, so then it ratchets up another level. Jesus' family tries to stop him. So the very next day, the family hears about it, and they say, well, he must be possessed, and they go to try to restrain him. And then they call for him, and this is where he tells everyone, who are my mother and my brothers? It's my followers. Whoever does the will of God is my brother and sister and mother. So now he's just rejected his whole family. So do you feel the whole buildup? We've gotten to this point. I mean, I feel like when you're reading it through, you're just like, what is going to happen next? How is this going to end? How will this possibly be resolved? And how can this possibly spell victory of any kind? And then the next words are the gospel reading that we had today. So with all these questions swirling in their heads, Jesus begins to teach, the first time teaching in the Gospel of Mark, with the parable of the sower. So why this? Why here? When things are so tense and scary, this is where Jesus is starting to help his followers figure out what kind of decision they have made by following him. And I think it's important to us too, right? If we count ourselves followers of Jesus and we're reading the Gospel of Mark, it's the point for us too, because a lot of that stuff so far is also troubling to us. None of us are standing up and proclaiming, yes, reject your parents and your siblings and just go with your church family. None of us are standing up and saying, yes, put the new wine in new wineskins and forget about John in prison. That's all really troubling to us too, right? I often think about this with all of the ones. I mean, we are, not necessarily in their hearts that won't change, but we are the Pharisees of the day. We're the established religion. We're the majority religion in our country. So we just are. And then the question is, will we act like the Pharisees in the story act with keeping our hearts hardened and wearing the Free John shirts on the outside, but then siding with the Herodians in conspiracy? Or are we going to have our hearts open to follow Jesus when he presents himself, right? So I often think, like, we're the Pharisees in this story, right? We're not the disciples. None of us left our jobs to wander in the countryside with a celebrity preacher. So we're listening to this. He wants to tell that. So we get to this point in the gospel, and the disciples are wondering, what does this all mean? We too are wondering, what does this all mean? And we get the parable of the sower. Because maybe the disciples thought, and maybe we thought, like John the Baptist, that once the Messiah showed up, it would just, everything would be great from there. That once the Messiah showed up, it would all be downhill. Maybe we thought that once we made the decision to follow Jesus, once those disciples dropped their nets and immediately go, that everything would be all right. That there would only be victory. And that everyone would see this revolution as the good news that we see it as. But Jesus tells them, listen, not everything is going to come up roses for you, or grain in the parable. What feels like news of victory to you now is not always going to line up with other people's idea of victory, or your own idea of victory. Not everything that feels like news of victory is going to end up with health and wealth. This is not a romantic comedy where once that seed of love is planted, you know, like that original meet cute, you can be sure that couple will end up together and that this will grow and blossom into love in the end. This is not like that. It's a suspense thriller drama, and we do not know how it's going to end. Some of those seeds that are planted, are going to be eaten by birds. Some of those seeds that are planted are going to be scorched. Some of those seeds that are planted are going to be choked by thorns. And just because Jesus is on the scene, and these crowds have chosen to follow him, and these disciples have dedicated their lives to him, does not mean that trouble is over. John the Baptist will never make it out of prison. There won't be some daring rescue. Hearing the good news about Jesus does not change Herod Antipas's heart and bring about justice. No, Herod heard the good news, and the good news of it withered away, and injustice persisted. And hearing the seed of the good news did not change the Pharisees. No, they heard the news, but the good news for them was choked by worry and fear of losing power and losing control. And this good news did not change all of the illness or heartache or death or mourning in the world. I think Jesus is telling the disciples right here, right now, with his first parable, and I think Mark wants us to hear it that way too. I think Jesus is saying, don't expect this to be pain-free. Don't expect this to come without opposition. We've seen Jesus doing all of these healings and miracles, but not every illness will be healed. Not everything will be healed on this journey. In the same field, the parable tells us, the very same field where the good news is spread, there comes up in some places trouble, worry, pain. But also, in that very same field, joy and hope and extreme fruitfulness. All of these things exist throughout Mark's story, throughout the story of Jesus. And all of these things exist in our story. Even in the midst of our mourning and our grieving, right? There are moments of joy. And even in the midst, in the same, very same field as our joy, we get bad news and we know that not all is right in the world. We see it in the global news on that scale, reading the news. We know that there are beautiful things happening and there are terrible things happening. We know even in the very same community, there is heartache and there is joy. In the very same church, there is worry and there is hope. And in the very same heart, those things can exist and grow too. And I think that's good news. Because then we are not left alone in our pain. We are not isolated in our mourning. Our news of victory just looks different than we had imagined. But in the same field, trouble can grow and also great joy. So may we have our hearts open for all of the things that might be planted and grown in them. In the name of God, the Creator, Christ, and Holy Spirit, amen.